May I thank the History Trust of South Australia and the Friends of the Barsmith Library very much for inviting me back to Adelaide to give this talk. I spent five very interesting years here in the late 70s and early 80s. I was the Master of St Mark's College and also doing a bit of history teaching at the university. And more recently, for my last two-book project, I did some most enjoyable research in the Barsmith Library. So I hope you may count me as a friend of the Barsmith Library, even with a small f. So it's very good to be back, always good to come back to South Australia, especially as my Adelaide-born wife is currently working here. And so I've tried to work in a few South Australian references into what I have to say this evening. Well, this year is, of course, the 40th anniversary of 1968, when it seemed that revolutions were either breaking out or on the brink of breaking out all over the Western world. Australia, of course, likes to lag a little behind elsewhere. And as Peter Cochrane once said, Australia's 60s happened in the 70s. And as that current exhibition at the History Trust indicates, it seems that the Vietnam War was not only the subject of major protest in itself, but a catalyst for changes to many major institutions, governmental, political, educational, ecclesiastical, and social conventions, leading, of course, to concerning attitudes and policies, especially towards Aboriginals, towards women, towards gays and lesbians. So what I hope might be of interest to you this evening is to discuss how another institution of a sort, the Australian Official War Histories, coped with this period of challenge and controversy when we were writing and publishing about the Vietnam War and its impact in those volumes which mostly came out in the 1990s. Now, as I hardly need remind an audience like this, the Official War History tradition was started by Charles Bean with his 12 volumes with covers, as an earlier reviewer put it, the colour of dried blood for the 1914-18 war. And they had such an impact that the tradition was continued by a 22-volume series under Gavin Long as official historian for the 39-45 war, and then two volumes by Robert O'Neill on Australia's involvement in the Korean War. So as the fourth official historian in that tradition, I've been responsible for this 9-volume series, as you've heard, on those three Southeast Asian conflicts: the Malayan Emergency of the 48 to 60, the confrontation between Indonesia and Malaysia, 63 to 66, and by far the biggest, of course, the Vietnam War. There is now a fifth official history series in preparation on peacekeeping and post-Cold War operations under a former South Australian, David Horner. All these histories were written basically on two fundamental principles: unrestricted access to all official records and publication without official or political censorship. So Australia has a worthy tradition of war histories that were made possible by official support but not officially censored. So how has this tradition fared in moving from two world wars and Korea, in which there was general support for Australian involvement, to the very controversial field of Vietnam? Moreover, as all institutions, and especially anything labelled official, was challenged in the 60s and 70s, I've always been conscious of the need to assert the continuing validity of the official war histories. After all, when Charles Bean and, to a slightly lesser extent, Gavin Long were writing, and their respective colleagues, there were very few academic or freelance historians writing about Australian history. The expectation when they were doing it was that theirs would be practically the only Australian histories of their subject. Well, the position is very different today. So do we still need official histories? And if so, why? Well, I'm not exactly an unbiased observer, but surprisingly enough, I think that we do, for several reasons. An official historian has the privilege of working with a team of writers and researchers with different fields of expertise, whereas historians generally tend to be rather lone wolves. So official history can give detailed coverage to a broader range of topics, and I'd emphasise this, the connections between those different topics and different areas of study, than would be possible by an individual historian writing a typical book, whether for an academic market or a general audience. Moreover, academic historians, with some notable exceptions, including Trevor Wilson and Robin Pryor from this town, generally do not give military and related topics, diplomatic, strategic topics, a terribly high priority in their work. There's been a general tendency to favour social history and other such topics. On the other hand, journalists and other freelance writers are only too willing to tackle military topics. You can't go into a bookshop now without being overwhelmed by that plethora of books by these freelance writers like Les Carlyon, Peter Fitzsimons and the rest. They're usually large, square books with dramatic covers and punchy one-word titles. Gallipoli, Tobruk, Kokoda, Vietnam. But these books often rely extensively on the official histories. Sometimes they acknowledge it. Sometimes they quote us accurately. But whether they do or not, they could not achieve their enviable sales, their great influence, and the prizes which some have won, like Les Carlyon's The Great War, winning the inaugural Prime Minister's Prize. They could not do that without the groundbreaking work of the official historians. But there's a further reason, I think, for the official histories that derives from the fact that Australia's wars in the first three quarters of the 20th century were generally fought in coalitions led by Britain or the United States or both. A major reason for commissioning Bean's history and its successors was to ensure that Australia's contribution to the two world wars and Korea was not overlooked or overwhelmed in public memory, both in Australia and elsewhere, by the much greater and often more dramatic and, let's face it, more globally significant war effort of Britain and the United States. Now, when it came to those Southeast Asian conflicts that I was covering, there was a related but slightly different issue. For many Australians, Vietnam has come to be seen through the perspective of the enormous outpouring of works on the American experience of that war. Seldom has it been so true that history has been written by the losers of a war. Because the Americans have produced everything ranging from Rambo movies through quite high quality documentaries and films through to the works of the highest scholarship. But it focuses enormously on the American experience of the Vietnam War. Now, surprising as it may seem, I'm not the sort of person who walks around literally wrapped in an Australian flag, either to go for a walk on Cronulla Beach or to watch a one-day cricket international. But there is a sort of patriotic purpose behind the official history as I see it. I wanted very much to get across the message that Australia's Vietnam experience, while it's obviously similar to and parallel to the American experience in many ways, obviously heavily influenced by the American experience in many ways, but the Australia's experience of the Vietnam War was also very different in some important ways from the American experience. So although it's not always explicit, sometimes it's just there in the subtext, as it were, but there is a constant current, I think, in much of what my colleagues and I have written of comparison with, in the Vietnam case, the United States, and constant attention to examining the extent to which ideas and concepts came from the United States or indeed elsewhere, and the extent to which they drew on Australian conditions and traditions. So let me give some indication of how that played out in the various areas that we covered, and as Margaret has indicated, we covered quite a number of different areas in the volumes. I think when people think about the Vietnam War, four classic, or to use that much overworked and abused word, iconic figures tend to come to mind. First, there's the policymaker, the man in the grey flannel suit, involved in the decision to commit forces. Secondly, there's the serviceman, in the Australian case, usually an infantryman, conducting the actual operations. And thirdly, there's the protester on the streets or on the university campuses. And fourthly, the disaffected veteran suffering from diseases, which he may have attributed to Agent Orange. So let me make some comments on those four areas: strategy and diplomacy, operations, protest and dissent, and medical matters. In the official histories of the two world wars, there was relatively little coverage of Australian strategy or strategic or diplomatic activity, and there are various reasons. In the First World War, there simply wasn't much to tell, at least until Billy Hughes got into the Imperial War Cabinet. After 1945, it seems that a decision was taken that it would not be tactful to talk about the disagreements that occurred between Australian leaders and their counterparts in London and Washington. So that tended to be bypassed. And such coverage as there was put into the volumes essentially on domestic politics, Australia During the War by Ernest Scott, and the two volumes on the government and the people by Paul Hasluck. The breakthrough in this area came with Robert O'Neill's Korean War history. And he found that there was so much to say about Australian diplomatic activity that he divided what was going to be a one-volume history into two, one on strategy and diplomacy and one on operations. And the former, I think, has had an enormous impact, and it remains, in many ways, the standard source on the origins of the ANZUS Treaty. Now, Korea was the first of what some historians have called Australia's wars of diplomacy. So I was determined that the way we got into Vietnam should be adequately covered and placed in the broader context of Australian foreign and national security policy. I imagine that the selection committee took the same view because they chose somebody with a background more in diplomatic history than military operations to undertake the job. At the start, the project was initially described as an official history of Australia's involvement in just two conflicts, the Malayan Emergency and the Vietnam War. But I soon developed the view that we could not provide an adequate explanation of Australian diplomacy in this period, and in fact how we got into Vietnam, without incorporating the confrontasi, the Indonesian confrontation of 1963 to 66. It took me a while to convince the powers that be of this. Anything to do with Indonesia tends to be regarded with great sensitivity. But after a while, I finally got approval, and that's when the series became designated the Official History of Australia's Involvement in Southeast Asian Conflicts, 1948 to 1975. And I should apologise to librarians that it's such a long series title. I apologise for any RSI that I've been responsible for. This eventually took shape as 9 volumes, as you've heard. The 9th is still in progress. Of those 9, 6 are on military operations, 3 being on the army in Vietnam, 1 on operations in the emergency and confrontation, 1 on the Air Force in Vietnam, 1 on naval operations throughout the period. Then there's 1 on medical matters, and then the 2 for which I was personally responsible on politics, diplomacy and strategy, including both high politics and street politics. Now, the first was Crises and Commitments, which related the development of Australian policy through the Malayan Emergency in the 50s and confrontation in the 60s up to the major military commitment to Vietnam in 1965. And I really wanted to make the point there that Australia's path to Vietnam was different from the American path. The Australia's path lay through involvement in Malaya, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Very different from the American road to Vietnam, which was initially about restoring post-war France, then concern about the balance between China and Japan, and also a concern for the credibility of the worldwide alliance structure that the United States had. But I want to get the message across that we did not get into Vietnam, as is so often said or implied, simply because the Americans came along, twisted our arm and said, we want you there, and so we had to go. The Australian government, for its own reasons, had a long-standing concern about developments in Southeast Asia, especially the growing strength of communist and radical movements, and had adopted a strategy of forward defence under which, well before the Vietnam commitment, it had already engaged in those two regional conflicts, and it had shown a willingness to commit forces to others if required. For example, at one point it looked as if there a major conflict would erupt in Laos, and people were even talking about the possibility of nuclear weapons being used. And the Australian government had bitten the bullet and indicated that it was willing to do that if required. It's remarkable today that many Australians are quite unaware of the importance that both policymakers and the general public attached to those two earlier conflicts, the Malayan Emergency and confrontation. For example, in 1955, when Australian troops were committed to Malaya, it was the first time that Australia had ever sent troops abroad other than for a declared war. And this was a major political issue at the time. Now, the debate over Malaya in the 50s in many ways prefigured the debate over Vietnam in the mid-60s. And the fact that the Malayan commitment had proved successful by 1960 was very much in policymakers' minds and encouraged the government in the 60s to think only a few years later that there was a reasonable chance of success in Vietnam. And somewhat similarly, the way that Indonesia and the confrontation between Indonesia and Malaysia, the way that affected policymakers and the way it played into our decision-making that led to Vietnam is a major theme which I think writers have too often overlooked. At the time, in the early 60s, Australian policymakers were very worried about what was going on in a number of parts of Southeast Asia, actual and potential conflicts. But generally, they were much more worried about anything to do with Indonesia than they were on with what was happening on the mainland, so to speak, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. But the two were, in fact, related. For example, at one point in, I think it was 63, a very senior American diplomat, Avril Harriman, came for confidential talks, and he met the entire Australian cabinet. And the cabinet made it clear they were very worried about what was happening in Indonesia. The Australian and Indonesian soldiers were actually shooting and killing each other, albeit in small numbers. But the Australians were saying, this could escalate at any time. Now, just how serious does it have to get before we can say to you in America, we think this is serious enough, we want your help under the ANZUS Treaty? And the reply was, well, you can handle the Indonesians. You know, don't go in too heavy because you'll only drive them more into the hands of the communists. But in any case, how much we help you depends to some extent on how much you help us elsewhere. Now, what does elsewhere mean? Well, the next item on the agenda is Vietnam, this growing conflict in Vietnam. In other words, when people say that getting into Vietnam was a matter of paying the premium on our strategic insurance policy, yes, that was part of it, as well as our own concerns over Southeast Asia. But it was not just a general thought that one day we might be in strife and we'll therefore need the Americans' help. It was a very specific, immediate, and concerning issue that was right on the at the forefront of Australian minds at the time. And I also like to think that the two volumes on diplomacy, Crises and Commitments and A Nation at War, has had a fair degree of influence on how we look today at the history of our relations with Britain and the US. For example, it often used to be said that Australia simply switched its primary relationship from an alliance with Britain to an alliance with the United States. Labour people like to say it was when John Curtin made that famous statement in December 1941, that Australia looks to America free of any pangs as to our traditional links and kinship with the United Kingdom. And that was why Kevin Rudd last September during the APEC meeting gave a biography of Curtin to President Bush to underline that point. That was when Labour people liked to think the Australian-American alliance was founded. Liberals like John Howard and Alexander Downer take a rather different view, and they say, no, it was when Percy Spender negotiated the ANZUS Treaty in 1950-51, which has a lot going for it. But in fact, we were balancing our alliance relationships with Britain and the United States for 20 years, from 1945 to 1965. And in those two conflicts in Malaya and Borneo, we fought alongside Britain, but not alongside the United States. Vietnam was the first conflict in which Australia was involved without fighting alongside Britain. And in some ways, that is a major turning point. And that played out in some very interesting and complex diplomacy in the 60s, because when both confrontation and Vietnam were brewing, as it were, the British were saying to us, Indonesia is the real threat. Sukarno is the new Southeast Asian Hitler. We've got to stop him before he takes over the rest of Southeast Asia and out into the South Pacific. And look, be careful about Vietnam. We're not going to get involved there. That's, you know, that doesn't look so good. The Americans at the same time are saying to us, you can handle Indonesia. Don't worry about Sukarno too much. You guys can look after him. Now, the really important conflict that's going on is this one up in Vietnam, and that's where we need your help. And this made for very interesting times for the Australian policymakers who are trying to keep in with both and trying to get both Britain and the United States on the same track. So let me pass from that, because this carries, I think it's important to get some of that background, because it carries over into the other areas that I was dealing with. For example, in military operations, what emerges from our study of the military operations is that the Australian forces, and particularly the army, which was by far the one most deeply committed in Vietnam, they too, in going to Vietnam, carried, so to speak, the mental baggage of Malaya and Borneo. So that Australians went into Vietnam thinking that we knew a good deal about jungle fighting in Southeast Asia. We'd had that experience in Malaya, we'd had the experience in Borneo, and for some people there was the experience of New Guinea in World War II. Now the Americans, by contrast, had a huge, vastly larger, vastly more powerful army, but that had been developed primarily for large-scale conventional war on the plains and steppes of Europe, in case the Russians should invade Western Europe. And the Americans placed great reliance on technology, on heavy power, firepower, and huge numbers in a way that was just out of the question for Australia. Now this gave rise, especially in the earlier part of the Australian commitment to Vietnam, to some fairly robust clashes between senior American and Australian officers. The Americans said that the Australians were too reluctant to engage in major contacts with the enemy and too reluctant to gauge success by the so-called body count. Whereas the Australians felt confident that their tactics, which emphasised small patrols, low-level activity, patient ambushes, they felt that was much more appropriate for jungle fighting in Southeast Asia. Now, if there's one thing we learned from all those thick square books that I was talking about, is that Australians love to read about our fat chap's military prowess. We love to read how much smarter the typical Australian digger was than a senior British or American general. Well, I'm a good patriot, and in general, the Australian military record in Vietnam is one of which the nation can be proud, and in many ways, it is an outstandingly good record. But I don't think we should fall into the trap of jingoistic narratives, of flag-waving exercises, saying how we always got it right and Big Brother always got it wrong. Vietnam was a complex war. It was fought at several levels. At the level of pacification, the low-level stuff in the villages, Australian views did carry some weight. And it's notable that the second American commander in Vietnam, General Abrams, was much more sympathetic to the Australian approach than the first one, General Westmoreland. But the Australians also had to realise that the Americans had a point when they said that there was more going on than just that sort of war. Because by the late 60s, the enemy included not just small units of guerrillas, but large formed conventional units. There were major large-scale battles in which our side had to rely on tanks, artillery, air support, all the other elements of heavy conventional conflict. Indeed, even in the relatively small-scale Battle of Long Tan, which has achieved a status in the Anzac tradition now almost equivalent to Gallipoli, Tobruk and Kokoda, the Australian soldiers would have been in deep, deep trouble without the support of artillery and armoured personnel carriers. But one of the major themes of the operational volumes, and this also affects other areas that I'm going to talk about, is the vast difference between the Vietnam War that was experienced by the Australians, particularly the soldiers in Phuc Thuy province, and the Vietnam War that was being portrayed on the nightly television news, that was being debated in Parliament, that was being denounced by protesters and dissenters on the streets and on the university campuses, not only in Australia but all around the world. That war, when people said we're protesting against the Vietnam War, they were protesting essentially against the American War. But many of aspects of that war and many of the features that protesters particularly decried, like the use of napalm, for example, were not part of the Australian experience. They were not part of the Australian armoury. And much of the tension that emerged between servicemen and protesters, I think, can be traced to this disjunction between the Australian war, as experienced by the task force in Phuc Thuy, and the American war that was the focus of protests all over the world, including Australia and America. Both sides, I may say, largely ignored the South Vietnamese War, the South Vietnamese suffered more casualties than the Americans, but you'd never have gauged it from what was being said in the media. But this brings me to the third of my iconic figures, the protester. Right from my start of the project, I was aware of a good deal of interest and a certain amount of tension concerning the way that I would treat the anti-war protest movement. There were some people who wanted a triumphalist treatment of protest. As they saw it, protests had been successful in bringing an end to Australian involvement, and the outcome had vindicated all the arguments that they had ever put forward. But there were other people who felt that protesters and dissenters had no place even being mentioned in an official war history, except to denounce their more outrageous acts, especially at those aimed at those who served in Vietnam as distinct from those who took the political decisions that sent them there. There was a rumour going round, I discovered when I came to take up the job, that I was going to appoint Jim Cairns to write a special volume on the home front history. It took me a little time to disabuse people of that. I decided that we should treat all sides of the debate over Vietnam with balance, showing appropriate respect to all points of view and making an independent and, as far as humanly possible, objective assessment of all the different arguments and actions. And I take some pride in the fact that many reviewers sympathetic to the protest movement have said, sometimes with a faint air of surprise, that the official history turned out to be remarkably fair. But what was most important, I think, was the decision not to treat the protest movement as a story in itself. That, I think, is one of the traps that's easy to fall into. But rather, I decided to merge coverage of protest and dissent with that of both domestic and international politics. And that was the case to some extent in Crises and Commitments, and especially in the second one I wrote, A Nation at War. It seems to me that the historian can give the reader a much better understanding of what is happening if what he writes about is to show what at any given time is being argued on the streets or on university campuses and what's being debated in Parliament, and at the same time what's being discussed in cabinet meetings and in top secret cables between Canberra and Washington or Saigon. It's through that, I think, that you get a much more realistic assessment of the wisdom and the political influence of the various participants in the debate. And one of the things that emerges most clearly is that it's hard to talk of the protest movement, it's more a matter of movements in the plural. Because one of my themes was the fundamental importance of the division between, and I'll use shorthand here, the moderates and the radicals. There were those who simply wanted to remove Australian forces, especially national servicemen, from the war. And there were others who wanted to use the Vietnam War not so much for its own sake, but as an impetus towards fundamental challenges towards Australia's political institutions. And this, I think, covers any assessment of who was right and who was proved wrong, terms which I would be reluctant to use, by the outcome. But certainly those people who said, this is not a good war to get into, this is going to cost us a lot more than we realize, come out fairly well. Those who were saying, as some were, that we're actually fighting on the wrong side in this war, it's actually a good war, it's just the other side of the good guys, do not look so well in the light of history. But that division between moderates and radicals reflected a worldwide phenomenon. And one of the enduring questions that was posed to some extent at the time and has continued to be the subject of debate ever since was the extent to which the Australian protest movement relied on ideas and concepts from overseas, not just from the United States, Berkeley and Washington and all the rest, but also Britain and France and Germany and Sweden, countries which, of course, weren't even involved in Vietnam. Now, some of the forms of protest were very clearly imported. The teach-ins, for example, endlessly long all-night seminars that went on in Australian universities, well, they were imported. The whole idea and the concept was imported from the United States. But then they were adapted somewhat, and Australian teach-ins had a slightly different atmosphere, I think, and a different tone from the American ones. And this goes right through to the moratorium movement, the great demonstrations of the early 70s. Well, the very term moratorium was an American invention and not one that Australians had ever used before. But at the same time, these sorts of ideas and concepts, the techniques that were used by the protest movement, merged with those which had a long indigenous tradition in Australia. And the most important of these, of course, was opposition to conscription for overseas service. Now, that goes way back to the debate over the 1903 Defence Act. At that time, Australians came to a sort of what the Italians would call a compromesso storico, a historic basic compromise. Australians would accept compulsory military service within Australia. They would not accept it for service abroad. Strategically, it may not make much sense, but it's dear to the hearts of Australians. And that principle, when it was challenged, led to, of course, major controversies in both the world wars. And then it was overturned by the system that was introduced in 1964. Now, given the importance that conscription had in the whole anti-Vietnam War dissent, I think it was important to go back to the fact that when the system was introduced in 1964, the system which produced so much of the protest movement, when that was introduced, it was as much with Indonesia or more with Indonesia in mind than it was with Vietnam. At the time conscription was introduced, the Australian policymakers feared that Indonesia-Malaysia might escalate, the Indonesians might take the war across the border to New Guinea, and at that stage, that was our only land border because the Indonesians control West New Guinea and we controlled East New Guinea. And then there was the possibility of a third conflict on the mainland, and at that stage, people thought it was more likely to be Thailand or Laos than Vietnam. But Indonesia was much more prominent in people's minds. On the day that the conscription system was announced, the editorial in the Sydney Morning Herald was headlined, "Preparing for War Against Indonesia." But dramatic events in the period 64, 65, 66 meant that the whole operation of the system changed around, and it ended up sending, as we all know, national servicemen to Vietnam rather than to Indonesia or to Borneo. Moreover, one of the things that we worked on that came out of our study of the introduction of conscription was that the army hadn't particularly wanted it at all. Much of the protest assumed that the army was behind this system of conscripting Australia's youth. Senior officers in the army had no desire to take on the role of disciplining Australia's turbulent youth, give them a haircut, teach them a bit of discipline and knock them into shape. They didn't see that was the army's role. They wanted to strengthen the army's numbers by improving the pay and conditions. Who wouldn't? But then, as now, there was an economic boom going on and they simply couldn't compete with the private sector. So the government essentially forced a conscription system onto the army, rather unwillingly. Now, this gives all sorts of interesting nuances to the subsequent story. During Vietnam, much was made of the arguments between generations, you know, father against son and all that. And so it seemed highly symbolic when Robert Wilton, who was the son of the highest ranked serving officer in the Australian Defence Force, General Sir John Wilton, when young Robert Wilton burnt his national service papers in the dramatic gesture outside Parliament House. And when he was asked about what his father thought of that, he said, "Oh, well, you know, my father and I respect each other's views." In fact, very few people were aware, because it had been kept quiet, but 5 years earlier, when the system was introduced, General Wilton had been head of the army, and he had led the army's resistance to the introduction of a conscription scheme. There's another story which, to my mind, has received rather less attention than I thought it might have. And that concerns the death of Errol Noack, who was a South Australian. He was the first national serviceman to be killed in Vietnam. Now, that led, as you might expect, to a number of to quite a lot of protests and strikes and so forth. There was graffiti on the Cross of Remembrance in Pennington Gardens, just near the cathedral across the river. We looked at that episode very closely. I got one of my team, who was a retired colonel who had been a staff officer in Vietnam, very loyal to the army and all that, but also very loyal to the truth. And he undertook a careful study of the army records. And what emerged from that is that it was, one can't be certain, but it is certainly more likely than not that Noack's death was caused by a so-called friendly fire, what soldiers call blue on blue. And I spelled out in Nation at War how that could have happened. I also spelled out what I thought would have been the implications if at that particularly sensitive time, the death of the first national serviceman, if it had been known that that was likely to have been caused by friendly fire, two companies happening to fire on each other, each thinking the other was the enemy. And I hinted as strongly as I thought the evidence warranted that the military and political authorities may have misled the public by indicating that that Noack had died from enemy action. Now, also in Nation at War, again, because conscription was so important, we put into that volume, into the volume, Nation at War, what no other history of Australian involvement has perhaps been able to do or certainly seen fit to do, and that is a detailed summary of the legislative and legislation and administration covering the national service system. It's there for anyone who cares to consult it. And that should include anyone who wants to look into allegations that the birthday ballot was rigged. If you were around at the time, you'll remember there were rumours galore about that. But it's we published not only how the system operated, but the date of every birthday that was drawn out of that ballot. Now, that should be sufficient to prove stories such as one which appeared in the Melbourne press just a couple of months ago. I don't know if we've got an airing here, about Normie Rowe, who protested, I'll tell you a story about that afterwards if you like, but he raised that story in the early 1990s. And we established then what had happened and how it was that his number had been pulled out, whereas some other people with the same birthday had not been pulled out. There's a perfectly legitimate reason for that. I was quite surprised when the same journalist and Normie Rowe repeated the claim just about 2 or 3 months ago. But I come now to my last of my four iconic figures, the disaffected veteran. Perhaps no other war in Australia's experience has had such a long, troubled and controversial aftermath as the Vietnam War. Now, there are many elements in this. I'll touch on one very briefly because I'm pushing close to my time. But the whole question of Agent Orange and the case pressed by a group known as the Vietnam Veterans Association of Australia that many of the mental and physical ailments suffered by veterans and their families were caused by herbicides. we produced a medical volume in the tradition of those that had been done for the First and Second World Wars. In the first three parts of that volume, Brendan O'Keefe writes of medical matters, including, and this is something which perhaps is a bit unusual and distinctive about an official history, the things that didn't happen. Now, have you ever heard of the malaria outbreak in Vietnam that created as many casualties as enemy action? Probably not, because it didn't happen, but it very nearly did. It's not unusual for tropical diseases to cause as many casualties as enemy action. And at one point in Vietnam, the rate of casualties from malaria began to rise alarmingly. And the hierarchy had a very difficult decisions to take as to whether this was the soldiers failing to take their medicines and roll down their sleeves and so forth, or was it drug resistance by the malaria-causing parasites. The fact that the Army's head of medical services, a medical graduate of the University of Adelaide, had served in New Guinea in the Second World War, contributed significantly to finding the problem. I would say that I didn't write this volume, and any praise from him came well before I married that chap's daughter, who's But there's another section of the medical volume which caused a certain amount of a stir, and that was commissioned one of the Australia's great medical historians, F.B. Smith, to write on the Australian aspect of the Agent Orange issue. This created a certain amount of controversy when it was published in 1994 because it largely supported the conduct and findings of the Evatt Royal Commission, which famously found Agent Orange not guilty. Now, since that time, American and US governments have decided to give compensation to Vietnam veterans for certain cancers and other diseases on the grounds that it could be related either to war service or to chemicals like Agent Orange, and there's some very important decisions here. Now, it's often said that those decisions overturn the Evatt Commission findings, but I still believe, and I've been looking at this closely for something else that I've been writing, that Smith's account made a very valuable contribution to our understanding of the extraordinarily complex scientific, legal, and political issues that surround Agent Orange. It really is a nightmare. But I think that Smith showed some courage by arguing that those who actually pressed the Agent Orange issue did their fellow veterans a disservice, no doubt unintended. Because what they said was that all the post-war problems of mind and body, post-traumatic stress and so on, were not just due to war service, but they were specifically due to the herbicides known as Agent Orange. Now, that probably seemed a very good idea, but in fact what happened was that by focusing on the herbicides, so everybody had to argue, is this the case or is it not? And of course, it's extraordinarily difficult to establish whether that is the case or not. And the outcome was, in fact, to delay treatment and to obstruct compensation for all those who genuinely did suffer ailments, veterans and their families, who suffered from a wide range of ailments, most importantly, post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think, and it's, I don't have anything like the time to argue it here, but I think that in many ways Smith was right to say that the Agent Orange story was, as he put it, a tangle of decency and folly, courage and chicanery, but above all, waste. And that whole episode, of course, cast a shadow over the reputation of Vietnam veterans that took a long time to recover. And the whole story of the image of Vietnam veterans after the war is a fascinating topic in itself, but it's outside the scope of this official history and outside the scope of my talk tonight. So I hope I've given you some of the reasons why I think it was worthwhile to do an official history of Australia's involvement, not only in Vietnam, but in two other Southeast Asian conflicts in Malaya and Borneo. My team and I have sought to tell the Australian story in a way that we hope will long remain valid and useful for Australians, and not least in enabling comparisons with the experience of other nations. In strategy and diplomacy, in operations, in protest, in terms of the disaffected veterans, Australia's war experience was not the same as America's Vietnam War experience. And when we look at all the available evidence and put together those four different areas, We can see many of the old issues in a new light. We can debunk some long-standing legends. So I hope that this evening I've given you at least a taste of what lies in this multi-volume series and some idea of what it has meant to take that tradition started by Charles Bean nearly 100 years ago through the turbulent times of the third quarter of the 20th century. Thanks very much.